This is the Global Podcast Network, where executives and professionals connect, share, and inspire. Stay tuned for the conversations that drive success.
And welcome back, everyone. Are you, or maybe somebody you know, struggling with addictions, be it alcohol, drugs, gambling, anything that is getting in the way of you moving your life forward? We're going to talk about that today, show you the journey on how you can overcome these challenges. And most importantly, it should be stress-free. Life is so full of stress. And that is exactly the name of his practice, Stress-Free Recovery. James Martinez joins us on the program today. How are you doing?
Hi, good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you here. Lots for us to talk about. I'm curious, do you feel that there has been an uptick in addictions ever since COVID, the last like 4 or 5 years, that it's been more than what you've seen before that?
Yes, I have seen an uptick since COVID, but more in the traditional, not in the traditional alcohol and drug sense, the substance use. Where I've seen it starting to manifest more is more or less in the online gambling, the sports gambling, because that actually was a byproduct of COVID, and which ironically was when I first started my private practice, was when COVID started. Wasn't the best of time, but it took me to an interesting journey. And working with gamblers for the past 5 years also gave me an understanding of other behavioral addictions that are out there as well that I help individuals with. Like I help individuals with porn addiction or some type of sex addiction. Some individuals have some type of binge eating, especially emotional binge eating, which is not unlike the mental health version of anorexia, bulimia. People that are workaholics that also interfere with the quality of their life and their families. Shopaholics, hoarding. I mean, it's a whole new category of addictions out there. Because when people talk about addictions, we always talk about alcohol and drugs, maybe even cigarettes. But we don't think about the other world of addictions that actually still impact and affect us in other ways.
Going to basics here for a moment, how and why usually does somebody become addicted to something? Well, it doesn't matter what it is, as we say, gambling, pornography, whether it's alcohol. What is going on there that connects people with an addiction?
Well, it typically starts off, you start off with some type of behavior that you actually enjoy. This starts to generate some type of dopamine release into the brain. You know, most addictions start off very casually. Like individuals may start to drink, learn to drink socially with friends, high school, into college, eventually the enjoyable activity starts to take a life of its own, because you do develop some type of tolerance to the activity and what the dopamine means to you. Mm. And then it starts to expand from there. Now, it's the same way also with the behavioral addictions. So where with substances, you're smoking weed, you're smoking marijuana, and the more illicit drugs, where people may start very innocently to take painkillers, prescribed painkillers, and as they get addicted, they need more and more, and then they have to switch over to the illicits. Because the body becomes used to it, both psychologically and physically. Mm. And that's how the addiction progresses that way. But in behavioral addiction, it's really something very similar, with the difference that you're not putting something in you. the actual activity is generating that dopamine release. And because dopamine is associated with pleasure and it makes you feel good, you want to do more and more of it. And there are healthier ways to release dopamine that it's not going to affect, your quality of life. So when these activities start to create problems for you, that's when you pretty much can sense that it might be the start of an addiction.
Does it essentially or most often come back to dopamine? Just getting that hit of like, I just, that felt good. I went and I did a little gambling online, and then it progresses where it's like, I need another hit. I need to feel a certain thing. Is that essentially going back to dopamine?
Yes. But
Wow.
that's how it starts. But then what eventually happens in addiction, you become dependent on it to feel normal because your body starts to adapt. So now, if you, for example, used to feel tipsy with a couple of beers, now you need six. With gambling, for example, interesting enough, what really kicks off the addiction is really when they start to win. Because when they win, that's when the excitement really starts, not when they're losing.
But what keeps them going? Like, and I'll t I, you know, I have an app. I'll play the lottery instead of going buying a lottery ticket, and I don't do it often, but I just do it for fun. And maybe once a month I'll spend, I don't know, 25, 50 bucks or whatever. And just occasionally when the jackpot's big, Mega Millions, Powerball. But quite honestly, I wonder how it happens where you're just playing a little bit, $10 here, $10 there, not really winning. Every once in a while, you might win $3 back. It's not like, woo, hey, great time. How does that begin where you're not really winning, but what's keeping you hooked? If you continue to do that and now you start spending more, again, you're not really winning a lot, but what's keeping you hooked on that?
Well, if we're going to refer to, let's say, lottery tickets, and I have worked with clients who've been addicted to lottery. Usually the false sense of hope, hey, as you said, let's say the Mega Million or the Powerball gets into large numbers. Wow, if I were to hit it, it would solve all my problems. I would vacation for the rest of my life. And you have these dreams, and then you invest. Most individuals think of it as more as a donation. You're risking $10, $20. You're not going to really see it back unless you win. The problem really starts when you actually start winning. Let's say you win a 20 grand scratch off, or someone that actually hit a mega six, which I had a client who was actually a minor, by the way.
Wow.
In that particular case, then that opened up a whole bunch of problems for him. But when you win, let's say you're playing sports gambling and you win, you hit that first grand, that first big win, that sort of like generates an overload of dopamine. You get excited, hey, I got all this money. You feel good about yourself. And then that excitement you try to replicate. And then you feel more excited to try it again. However, because gambling is random, it's by odds, it's by luck of the drawers, as we like to say, when you start to lose, all that positive energy starts to flip over. And now it's negative energy. And if you invested money in which you weren't planning on spending, because it was repurposed, because you thought that you were going to be lucky enough to try to replicate what happened, then individuals start to chase the loss because they want to either get that money back to repurpose the bills. And even with going back to the traditional alcohol and drugs, and in the progression, as you start to grow to develop tolerance, it gets to the point that now you're trying to chase that original euphoria you achieved at some point toward the beginning. But now you need more and more, and you're trying to chase that original feeling. So you take more and more, and then it starts to create problems for you in some other way, whether it be physical, and that's where you first start to notice it. It can affect you socially. It can impact you mentally. So the traditional substance use addictions and behavioral addictions follow similar patterns. But what's very interesting is that if you have a drinking problem, like I could take 100 people, put them in a room, and I could say, Steve, there are 10 alcoholics in this room, or 10 people that have a drug problem, point them out to me. I'm sure you won't have too much of a problem seeing the person that has his eyes red, that are slurring. You can probably figure it out. But behavioral addiction is a little more tricky because they don't really generate any physical signs.
Right.
So if I tell you, Steve, you know, in that same room, they're like another 10 individuals that have gambling problems or are hooked on pornography, you probably would have a hard time trying to figure out one.
There's no signs. You would have no idea.
Right, because they keep it quiet. It's hidden. And then it's the consequences start to manifest itself in a totally different way.
How does one know that they are addicted? Like, you could be playing, you know, different sports sites. You could be playing the lottery, pornography. How does one know that, oh, I have an addiction?
I would say when you start to have any type of problems with whatever you're doing, that's the earliest sign. And nowadays, even for myself, I don't usually use the label alcoholic or addict anymore. I just simply say the individual has a problem drinking, problem with gambling, has a problem. It's because sometimes the stigma of labeling will make people scared and nervous to try to get help because the stigma itself is stressful. Oh, I don't want people to know that I have this. But if you start to recognize, hey, I have a problem, and sometimes it's not even a daily activity. I had the case of this young man who drank only once in his life. And he got so drunk during that one time, it caused a cascade of significant problems, legal problems, and he got kicked out of school because the behavior that became of that one event, that sort of like identified, you have a problem. So then he needed to go to treatment. So it's not always as clear cut that, oh, well, I don't do this every day. Oh, I have a job. So I'm okay. I don't have a problem. So we don't look at addiction under those terms. Even me growing up, when someone talked about, let's say, alcoholic, I was always thinking, I grew up in New York, you know, Brooklyn and Manhattan. So, so we visualize the Bowery bum with a paper bag, you know, so homeless on the street and all that. But actually, there's no discrimination. Many, many professionals, celebrities, all seem to have some type of problem. Because it's not about who you are, it's just the behavior. And a lot of it has to do with the thinking. And it all interconnects. And what's interesting is that if you start to develop a problem with one type of behavior, it's very easy to pick up a problem with something else. And that's the concept of cross addiction. So like some individuals, they find recovery stressful. Because they recognize they have a problem in one behavior, but they don't see that they have a problem in something else that's probably just as problematic, but they don't see it.
Is that what is often referred to as an addictive personality?
Yes, that's what some individual will describe an addictive personality. But really, there's a lot of science to it. You know, as your brain adapts to certain neurotransmitter activity with either one activity or one substance, If you start to do something else that's also going to generate that type of behavior activity, your brain has already learned it, has already adapted to it. So it's very easy if you're not careful enough to pick up something else. And sometimes that something else is really interesting done to get off the first one.
Replacement.
Replacement.
Wow. James, tell me your history. How did you get to this point where you help change people's lives when it comes to addictions?
Well, I actually am a person in recovery myself. This is sort of like a different chapter in my life. I like to think of my life as a book with different chapters. So there was a point many years ago that I actually became disabled and I wasn't able to work, and I was also still on Social Security disability. And then that's when my own drinking really took off. And I was always in and out of the hospitals. I was viewed as hopeless myself. But at some point, I stopped doing things how I'd like to describe it as the Burger King way, because people tend to do things their way. And I started to do things the right way, and I got my act together. Then I eventually decided to go to school. I sort of like feel like I didn't choose this profession. It chose me after I got sober, and I decided to, hey, I like to help individuals recover. I'm in recovery. So let me start to go back to school in my old age, which is how many individuals in the field get. Many individuals actually get to start to work in the field, but it's actually the wrong mindset. I quickly learned after a couple of years, because just because I'm in recovery doesn't necessarily mean that my way of recovery is going to be the same way for somebody else. And so it was very important for me to learn all the clinical stuff behind it. So I'm always constantly studying. So even right now I have clinical license in 5 states. I've done I'm clinical supervisors, certified clinical supervisors in 2 of the states. I've been a regional addiction manager, program manager, clinical director. I've held many administrative roles because I've also tried to help others, clinicians, grow in the field, because at some point I can't do it all by myself. I want to help and change the world by helping other individuals grow. Excuse me. I can actually help more people. As I started getting older, I decided to just start to work for myself, and this is where I'm at now.
Thank you for your transparency. You truly walk the walk and talk the talk, and beautiful in what you said, where this chose you. You can relate to others going through challenges. How does somebody know it's time for a, call it an intervention? How do you know?
Excuse me. A person would probably need an intervention when they don't realize that they have a need for change. So let me summarize it this way. There are 5 stages of change. And the first stage, we like to describe it as pre-contemplation, meaning I'm not thinking about it. I don't need to change, even though, excuse me, I have a, it's
No,
like
no
cough
worries.
here. So I don't need to change because I still have control of my life. You know what? I think if you're complaining about what I'm doing, maybe you have the problem. So right now I'm closed-minded. Now other people might see that it's generating some type of consequence, affecting relationships, finances. But hey, I still got my job. I'm still doing this.
So it seems like it may seem that, yeah, I think I might have a little something going on, but life's okay. I got my job and things are status quo. so to speak.
Correct. But at some point, I'm sorry, things start to happen. And then the person will start to think about it. Now, when they go into that contemplation state, they still haven't decided they want to get help. They're just thinking about it. People keep complaining, hey, maybe what did the doctor tell me? That maybe I should cut down or something. So the person starts to weigh the pros and the cons. And when they're in that stage, you can easily fall back. Meh, I'll just do it another way. I'll just cut down. Or they can eventually decide, you know what? This is causing so many problems. I'm actually going to do something about it. And then that's when they go into that preparation stage, and which is really, all right, I decided, what do I need to do? So then they get help, or they go to a support meeting. And once they learn what they need to do, then stage four is to put it into action. Now, someone that may need an intervention is usually a person that is in that first stage that's very resistant because they still think that they're holding on very, they see that it's causing problems, but the addiction takes too much of a hold on them that they don't want to do the effort. They get scared. And then this is where sometimes you may see a professional intervention. If you've seen the show Intervention on A&E, that's a little more dramatic. But the more common ones, family members will set some boundaries and say, hey, if you're not going to stop, you can't live here. If you want to stop, I'll help you get into somewhere else. And that's how you more or less see it. Or at least in my private practice, a lot of spouses may encourage their husband, hey, go and get help. If not, you can't stay here, or I'm going to leave you, and so on and so forth. And we call that external motivation. So they're not coming for change internally, for internal desire. There's some external pressure. And guess what? That's okay. But when they get to see someone like me, then we work with the person to try to develop that internal, try to move them along to that awareness that maybe they need to do something, and then that internal motivation starts to develop. But the process is very stressful. So what I try to do is try to help individuals go through that process with as minimal stress as possible. And that's why I call it stress-free.
I love that name, by the way, and I give you much credit for locking down that domain, which says it all. Share the website with everybody.
It's stressfreerecovery.com.
And that's what we want, recovery, but not a lot of stress. And you can operate or help people in a number of states, right? Which ones?
So my practice is a virtual practice. So I do telehealth, which allows me to help individuals in New Jersey and Maryland. And I am in network with many insurances in New Jersey and Maryland. I also help individuals in Pennsylvania. I am currently in the process of getting credentialed with insurances there. I can see people in New York and in Virginia.
And you also speak Spanish too, right?
I am bilingual.
Fantastic. James, thanks for being here today and making all of this easy to understand and breaking down the stages too, what somebody needs to do to move their lives forward. Lots more to talk about next time we get here. And I'm looking forward. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me on, Steve.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
This is the Global Podcast Network, where executives and professionals connect, share, and inspire. Stay tuned for the conversations that drive success.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie. This is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give a little talking to, man to man, mano a mano.
Hey, Steve! It's now a good time?
No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org, a public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.